solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Welcome to this new series of compilations at the Play to Potential Podcast. We're calling this series Connecting the Dots. As you might know, we recently crossed 100 guests at the podcast, and we're pressing the pause button on getting new guests, and we're using the opportunity to take stock and reflect on some of the learnings we've had at the podcast. So for the next several months, each new podcast episode will be a compilation around a theme, where I try and connect the dots between the various things we've learned at the podcast across the guests. We will do this for a period of time, and then after a few months, we'll get back to the long-term march towards adding to the library of guests at the podcast. We want to go through this phase of consolidation and taking stock before building further. To put it differently, I want to pause collecting the dots for a while and focus on connecting the dots. I sincerely hope you find these compilations helpful. This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. I'm based in Mumbai, and my mission is to help growth-minded individuals play to their full potential. My primary vocation is that of an executive coach and a sounding board to leaders. However, I realize that my bandwidth is finite and there are only so many people I can work with. Hopefully, this content can make a difference to a wider set of people who are keen on playing to their full potential. To know more, you can visit playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. The first theme we want to shine the light on is self-awareness. In a world of abundance and confusion, I genuinely feel self-awareness is a steering wheel that helps us navigate life. In my case, I feel I've spent a large chunk of time, possibly the first 30-odd years, trying to make sense of the external world. It's only in the last decade or so that I've turned the gaze inwards, and for me that's made all the difference. As a student of leadership, I've also come to realize that a lot of leadership is about being mindful of how we do what we do. And once again, the key prerequisite for that is self-awareness. So in the first couple of episodes of Connecting the Dots, we're going to shine the light on self-awareness. The first one will be about internal self-awareness, and in the second one, we'll explore external self-awareness. We'll look at what these are down the line. But let's start with a pretty provocative point of view by Venerable Tenzin Priyadarshi. He says the choice we have is between self-awareness and self-sabotage. His story is a fascinating one. He grew up in Vaishali in Bihar, and when he was a young boy, he left home pursuing a dream that he'd seen of a certain monastery. One thing leads to another, he gets there, becomes a monk, and long story short, today Venerable Tenzin Priyadarshi is the President and CEO of the Dalai Lama Center for Ethics and Transformative Values at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He recently released his book Running Towards Mystery, The Adventure of an Unconventional Life, which is a wonderful story of leaning into the mysteries of life and taking a leap of faith into the unknown. I would strongly recommend the book. He actually says that human beings actually don't really have a choice in this matter. There's no real middle path here.
I think first thing is to recognize that self-awareness is not a religious enterprise. It's a fundamentally, as I've mentioned in the book as well, that all humans are contemplatives by nature. You don't need to have a religious or a spiritual orientation to be that, to do that. And so when you speak of self-awareness, you know, it's a simple desire to better understand our own selves, to better understand our own mental dispositions, behavioral dispositions, and starting with that. And then you build this idea of self-awareness in a manner that deeply informs you, you see, about your own biases, about your own emotional landscapes, about your own chains and fetters that are not allowing you to grow. Then next level, the self-awareness informs you about relational awareness, meaning how do you relate to one another? Because we are social creatures, but there are ways of unhealthy relationships and there are ways of healthy relationships. And if we don't explore this sense of self-awareness, then we are tied into this narrative of just being consumers. We never look beyond transactional relationships. We may label it as loving relationship and caring relationship, but what is actually driving it is simple sense of transactions. What can this person do for me? I am willing to do this for this person, but what can this person give in return? And so this idea that can we ever think beyond that? Because if we cannot think beyond that, then we are not fulfilling, you see, the aspect of human evolution. How do you even continue having transactional relationship with nature at large by destroying the ecosystem? Because unless and until we understand the beauty of non-transactional relationships, which is rooted in this expansive idea of self-awareness, we are trapped. You see, we are curbing our own growth. It's like a self-sabotage. So I don't see a choice, you see. Either you pursue self-awareness or you self-sabotage. There's nothing in the middle.
Now that I hopefully have your attention, let's try and understand why self-awareness might be a foundational skill, on top of which a lot of other things rest. Let's first hear from Tasha Urich, a lady who studied self-awareness for several years. Her book Insight is a great read on the topic. She calls self-awareness the meta skill for the 21st century.
So what we know scientifically is that people who are self-aware are more promotable, they perform better in their jobs, they're more confident, they're better communicators, better influencers, significantly better leaders. There's even some evidence that leaders or companies rather who are made up of a large number of self-aware employees and led by self-aware leaders are actually more profitable than companies who aren't. And so the benefits are pretty clear in a business setting. And then they also follow us up to our home life. We know that people who are self-aware are more satisfied in their romantic relationships. They're more satisfied with their friendships. They raise more mature, less narcissistic children, which I think for everybody in the 21st century is pretty helpful. So if you just look at all of those things in sum total, there aren't very many skills that if you dedicate yourself to improving, you're going to see that wide range of benefits. But the reason I call it the meta skill, and this is really important, is that particularly in the workplace, our self-awareness is going to set the upper limit for our success. In other words, you know, think about the best communicator you know, or the best leader you know, or the person who is just the most effective on a long-term basis. They're only as successful as they are self-aware. Because if we're not able to see ourselves clearly, we can't come from a place of values-based behavior. We can't question our assumptions. We can't identify how we're impacting others and change our approach if we need to. So I really see it as kind of the foundational skill, not just to be successful at work, but really to be someone who lives a meaningful, successful, enjoyable life.
I find self-awareness paradoxical. I've noticed that if somebody claims that they are self-aware, the chances are they are not. The most self-aware people, I've come to realize, will tell you that they have a lot of work to do in this space. And therein lies the paradox. It's a domain highly susceptible to the Dunning-Kruger effect, I've observed. To put it simply, Dunning-Kruger effect is a bias where the people with limited competence in an area greatly overestimate their capability in that domain compared to the people with real competence. Barry Schwartz, a well-known behavioral economist who teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, speaks about the notion of paradox of choice. In a world with abundant choice, you would expect people to be happier. But his research says otherwise. He says that in a world of abundance, two things happen. First, decision-making gets complex when there are more and more things to choose from. And secondly, there's huge FOMO, fear of missing out. You start wondering if there's something else down the corner which might make you happier. The best parallel I can think of to understand this is in the world of media. When I was in the 7th grade, we just got a TV set, and watching Mahabharata on Sundays at 10 a.m. would give me reasonable happiness. When I look at my daughter who's in the 7th grade, she's choosing between hundreds of TV channels, plus content in OTT platforms like Netflix, Amazon Prime, Hotstar, Sony Live and so on. And if this was not enough, you have YouTube and other web streaming pages. She spends more time figuring out what to watch than watching. You get the idea. I think the same phenomenon is playing out in the world of careers. We grew up in a world where we chose between broad pathways, commerce, engineering, medicine, law, and so on. But now the possibilities are mind-boggling. And the same applies to the world of podcasts as well, bizarrely enough. There is infinite supply of podcast content, and I'm grateful that I have your ear. Given this abundance, I guess we all need some sort of internal anchoring. As the world of careers moves from looking like long highways to feeling like a maze, the steering wheel is going to become more and more important than the engine for us to thrive in this messy world. Rama Bijapurkar, a consumer behavior expert who sits on several boards, speaks about this eloquently.
You know, one of the young men actually I know said to me, he must have been, he was a student of mine from Ahmedabad, and I said to him that you're very lucky because you could do whatever you want, whereas my generation was told that if you made your bed, sleep in it. So my brother went to IIT for 2 years, hated it, was told to finish it, and then he went to the Indian Army after that on a permanent commission. So he said, ma'am, but you don't understand my anxiety. He said, my father's told me you can do anything you ever want to do. And he said, I'm always looking around the corner to see if there's something better. And I absolutely what you're saying, the fear of missing out. But I think the more there are choices, the more you have to be centered. The world is complex and volatile. And I think the more complex and volatile it is, the more you have to understand your center and your core. You know, going back to the earlier discussion we were having, you have to really, really understand. So if you are anchored, then you can withstand being buffeted. It's the same for companies too, right? I tell companies that if you're going to do competitor busting, and whatever the competitor came up with, you want to re-engineer it, reverse engineer it and do better. When you have 20 competitors who are putting out 20 products because they also don't know all ready, fire, aim, then are you going to bust 400? How do you know which 20 of the 400 to bust?
It's noise, yeah.
Yeah, so you eventually have to have a deep understanding of who you are and what you're trying to do with your customers and take it from there. So if you don't have that who you are understanding, or at least your navigational principles, I mean, I'm willing to sacrifice money for glory, or listen, I want a certain amount of balance in my life. And I think you then figure out, and even if the answer is that I have to do these things because I have to do them, though I believe something else, I'm saying as long as you know that's what it is, you'll be able to deal with it better. But knowledge is an absolute master of what is inside of you.
Personally, I can say that the first several years of my journey around engineering, B-school and management consulting were largely around following the herd. It was largely about what I ought to be doing. Subsequently, my transition from McKinsey to Egon Zehnder, and from Egon Zehnder to the current journey as a coach on a sounding board and as a podcaster, would probably not have been possible without some inner work. Jennifer Garvey Berger speaks about the different transitions all of us go through right from our childhood.
The earliest stage, I think of, is the magical mind, when little kids live in this world of wonder and exploration. Then as they grow, they move into what I think of as the self-sovereign mind, this world where they become the king or the queen of a tiny, tiny little kingdom of one. And then they begin to let the world in and begin to take on society and become really fully enmeshed in some other group and begin to take their identity and their cues from that group. And that's called the socialized mind. Then as we grow, some people, but not all adults, begin to move into a place where they're tired of just breathing in what society wants from them. And instead they begin to write their own story, which is why that form of mind was called the self-authored form of mind.
The credit for this model goes to Bob Keegan of Harvard, Jennifer's PhD advisor. What blew my mind is that his research says that 58% of adults are still possibly operating with a socialized mind. That's with an external locus of control. I can imagine that this can be a hard place to be when you have many twists and turns in the road ahead, when you lack an internal anchor. I think pursuing a journey of self-awareness is a key prerequisite to move to a self-authoring life, as Bob Keegan says. That's the journey I'm striving to be on. The other big learning I have in the journey of self-awareness is that we could think of self-awareness in two separate dimensions, internal and external, and the two could possibly be orthogonal and independent. Tasha Urich, who you heard from earlier in this conversation, talks about the distinction here.
Self-awareness is made up of two types of self-knowledge. The first is something we named internal self-awareness, which is essentially knowing who we are on the inside. But equally important is something called external self-awareness. And in a nutshell, what that means is knowing how other people see us. And what was fascinating, at least to me in our research, was that we found that those two types of self-knowledge, both are required for us to really be self-aware, but they're not related to each other, which I was kind of surprised by. I always thought, you know, if somebody kind of knows who they are from the inside, of course they would do the work and find out how they were seen on the outside and vice versa. But we discovered that they are, you sort of have to think about them as independent skill sets within the self-awareness area.
I discovered the orthogonality of internal and external self-awareness back in 2009 when I was evaluating career choices post-McKinsey. At that time, I had an internal narrative that said that I'm good at problem solving, number crunching, and so on, and I should be considering a career in venture capital or private equity or strategic planning roles in corporates. At that point in time, Ramesh Mangaleshwaran, a senior partner in the firm, looked at me and said, "You seem to have a people orientation. You should think of executive search." He then went on to connect me to the consultants at Egon Zehnder, and that one move changed my life. Now, this view of myself was completely in my blind spot, and like Tasha says, it was orthogonal to how I thought of myself at that point in time. There's no way I could have meditated my way to that insight. Let's now look at these two types of self-awareness one by one in a little bit of detail and granularity. Let's start with internal self-awareness in this episode, and in the next one, we'll focus on external self-awareness. The first opportunity I find in internal self-awareness is that very often people look at themselves only from the frame of strengths and weaknesses or development areas. This approach is possibly perpetuated by what happens in the workplace. However, that's such a shallow way of looking at ourselves. There are so many layers to look at. What do we value? What are we passionate about? What are our aspirations? What are our triggers? And so on and so forth. My first invitation to you is to widen the language with which you look at yourself. Of late, I've specifically started tuning into what gives me energy. There's one realization that I've had after starting this podcast, is that we can only play to our potential. We cannot work to our potential. This insight came from Abhijit Bhaduri, one of the guests at the podcast. We spend way too much time thinking about our strengths and too little time focusing on what gives us energy and what makes us tick and what gives us flow. The way I see it, if we are a sailor, our strengths are our skills as a sailor, but the tailwind is the passion that takes you places. Moving to a different theme, I feel another key element of self-awareness is tuning into where we come from. That's the thread that keeps the kite grounded, however high the kite might fly. When I work with leaders, especially when they are in transition, I find tuning into their formative years incredibly helpful. Sudhir Sitapati, MD of Godrej Consumer Private Limited and the author of CEO Factory, speaks about this in the context of brands.
They have to be true also to their, you know, one of the things I do a lot when I do brand work, DJ, is we do something called brand archaeology, which is go into the deep history, and many of our brands are very old, the deep history of the brand, the founder, and what was the vision with which it was founded, and what was that sort of birthing qualities of the brand? Because they tend to be the true qualities of a brand that, you know, 70, 80, 100 years later, and you've got to kind of rediscover it. And I think that's the truth about personal brands. I'm not an expert, as I tell you, but as I'm talking about it, I guess you just got to go within. You can't game it and say, what will that person like and what will this person like and how can I be? You got to understand what it is that you are. And whatever it is that you are, if you are true to it, people ends up liking you. I mean, so, you know, I think that, and that's true about brands. You know, the sharper they are, you'll always have people respecting you. They may not choose you, or, you know, they may choose something else.
However, it's crucial that while we connect back with our roots, we don't get trapped in a past sense of self, because that could come in the way of our evolution. Like most things in life, I guess this requires us connecting to the past but not holding on to it too tightly. This is beautifully articulated by Jeffrey Pfeffer of Stanford. In response to people who say they behave in a certain way because they're being true to self, he provocatively asked the question, true to which self?
This goes back to this whole thing about authenticity. You need to be true to your inner self or your true self. But, you know, I would hope that most human beings are on a journey of learning and development, and that Deepak, at your current age, whatever that is, because you look amazingly young to me, is not exactly the same person as Deepak at 10 or 5 or 20 or 25 or 30. Hmm. That my hope would be, and my, you know, from our conversation, my belief would be that you have been on a journey of learning and self-discovery, and that you have been on a journey of growth and development. And so that therefore, you know, when you say be true to yourself, if you're really true to yourself, you're basically not going to be on a journey of growth and development, because you're going to say, I have to be true to my one-year-old self, which basically doesn't use the toilet and doesn't work.
Got it.
I mean, that's an extreme example, but you get the point. The point is that as you have evolved, as people learn, you know, I believe in, you know, the redemption of souls. I believe that people can forgive. I believe that people can develop. I believe people evolve. At least I hope they do, you know. And so as they evolve, their values, their beliefs, their behaviors, everything will change. I don't think that's being inauthentic. I think that's called learning.
I guess we could go on and on about internal self-awareness. Let's take a pause here and spend some time talking about the how of internal self-awareness. The first point here is that we all need to slow down our tape. We're just moving from event to event and meeting to meeting, that often we don't create the space to pause and reflect. A couple of easy tactical steps here. First is to figure out pauses at different time scales. Hourly, daily, weekly, and possibly yearly. Something that I discuss with a lot of clients I work with. On an hourly basis, try and build breathing time in your calendar. Instead of a 1 hour meeting, have a 50 minute meeting and keep 10 minutes to gather and take stock. On a daily basis, try and schedule a 30 minute block in the middle of the day, which is me time. Helps you take stock of the day and course correct. On a weekly basis, try and block off 3 to 4 hours a week as one block to gather, reflect, think long term, and do deep work. And finally, try and take some time off once a year to be with yourself. I'm just coming back from a week in the hills with myself in Himachal Pradesh. I must confess, this is the first time I've taken a solo workation of sorts. But spending the time with myself gave me tremendous clarity and conviction on my why. So that's the first piece. Slow down the tape and build pauses at different time scales. While creating pockets of time for reflection is a good starting point, it's useful to be deliberately mindful in these moments. Carol Kaufman and David Noble talk about 3 dimensions of mindful alertness that can significantly enhance our self-awareness as leaders.
So those are all one-dimensional leaders, and they all fail in terms of being extraordinary. So we think that to literally be a whole person, a whole leader, someone who has the potential to be extraordinary, you need to be three-dimensional. So the first dimension is the external dimension, which is what is it that you want or need to accomplish? And that could be a financial target to hit. It could be a decision to make. It could be a merger to complete. It could be a culture to implement. But it's like, what is it that you're focused on doing? What do you want to accomplish? The second dimension is the inner dimension, which is, okay, we're clear on our goals, but who do you want to be as a human, as a person, while you're doing this? So do you want to be a leader who is patient, a listener, who has perspective, who's fair, who's inclusive? Like, what are the kind of character strengths and traits that you want to cultivate and project as a leader? And the third dimension is, you know, once you're clear on what you want to get done and who you want to be, the third dimension is, how can you best relate to other people so that you can achieve goals through them and achieve goals together? So for us, it's everyone knows the golden rule, which is, I will treat you the way I want to be treated. And I can tell you, in my own case, that works for a very small subset of the population, because I like to get the news direct, and not everybody does. So for us, it's more the platinum rule, which is, we want to relate to people in a way that they want and need to be related to, so that they can receive what we have to say and we can work together. So that's kind of the three dimensions. And Carol's got some examples, if that's helpful too.
Yeah.
Sure.
So the first one is, first of all, it can seem obvious what you are supposed to do. Like, you know, you go in, two examples is, one is, you walk into a team meeting, you're got to make a big decision. And so clearly your goal in the meeting is to make a decision. Well, what if that's not correct? And the actual goal is to create psychological safety so the team can have a good conversation, or, you know, to create a divergent thinking, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So one of the, like, sort of in terms of the quick tip, it's like, you walk into the room, see a bunch of people at the table, you're about to launch in, quickly ask yourself, what do I actually need to do? What's the most important thing? Like, am I right? Mm-hmm. That's okay. So what do I need to do? Then who do I want to be? And we sort of shorten that up to, who do I want to be right now? Mm. And, you know, and the bigger identity of who do I want to be, we actually have a number of, like, starter questions in the book for that. But it's, who do I want to be right now? And one example is, talked about that with one of our CEOs, who we suggested, and by the way, every single person, including you, I'd like to challenge you to do this, like, today, tomorrow, ask yourself, who do I want to be right now at every meeting? And then at every moment when you're annoyed. So you're at a store, there's the cashier in front of you who is talking and talking to someone about their vacation, and you're in a hurry. Okay, and just as about, you know, you want to say, like, excuse me, or explode, or just feel really frustrated, just say, who do I want to be right now? Now, the answer isn't, I need to be a nice person, but for you to have that choice of, who do I want to be right now? And this one woman, CEO of a major tech company, asked herself that before every meeting. This was during COVID, the 16th meeting of the day. She's like, I just want to go home. And, you know, going to the next meeting, she asked herself, who do I want to be right now? And that opened up the way for her to think, wait a minute, the most, like, the least important meeting of my day or of my week is the most important meeting of theirs. And then she then opened up, and a different her showed up. Like, who do I want to be? Do I want to be that bored person who phones it in and everybody can tell? Because leadership is often what you emanate more than you say. Mm-hmm. So that's that one. And then I think the, you know, how do you want to relate? I think David's example of the platinum rule is really just perfect. But the whole point is to make space for choice, or conscious choice.
The other practice that can really help deepening of self-awareness is journaling. I try and get the leaders I work with to maintain a journal. it gives them an opportunity to marinate in a certain thought. Otherwise, they end up bouncing from one moment to another without taking stock or adequate reflection. Rich Fernandez of Search Inside Yourself speaks about the benefit of journaling and how maintaining a written journal is almost like us running a version of date on ourselves.
One thing we know also, another bit of neuroscience, is that what they found is that people have a better memory for things they've written down than that which they've typed in a classroom setting. That's been a finding in neuroscience. And what neuroscientists have found is the reason for that is that because we can type faster than we can write longhand. And we could type almost at the speed of what's being spoken. And so basically what we're doing is we're just essentially quickly processing but not encoding what's being said, okay? And when you write something longhand, like when you journal, you actually have to articulate entire thoughts in your head and they become encoded in your memory in a much stronger fashion. And so basically you're programming yourself in another sense of the word when you journal. You're programming your brain to perceive a situation, you know, through a certain lens or perspective, and it becomes much more real and concrete. And in some ways you start to live your way into that, if that makes any sense. So what I would say for journaling to get started or to habituate it, make it more of a habit, think about a prompt. Today I feel dot, 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 and then just write for 2 minutes without stopping, stream of consciousness.
While there's adequate commentary about journaling and mindfulness, I've learned a couple of additional channels that can enhance our self-awareness. One is about listening to our body, and the other is about the third level of listening, which I'll get to in a minute. Let's talk about listening to our body and how it can help us when we experience complexity. Here's Jennifer Garvey Berger once again.
I mean, there's this way that many of us have been taught over centuries in our cultures and our societies that the mind is the great thing and the body is sort of the source of temptation or misleading data. And so we've learned to not trust or believe what our body tells us and really think that it's the mind that is the most glorious human achievement. Actually, when we look at sort of our psychobiology, our body is giving us signals all the time that our mind is making sense of very, very quickly and often reacting to without noticing that it was an embodied sensation that we were reacting to. So if we give someone, some studies that are greater, like if you give somebody a shot of adrenaline and then you have them meet a stranger, depending on the gender of that stranger, they're either likely to be more drawn to that person as a love interest or more threatened by that person as a possible threat or enemy after this shot of adrenaline than they were under normal circumstances. And they tend to attribute that to the other person, right? And they don't attribute that to their bodies in any way. And so their body is giving them a signal, and then they're acting out of that signal without ever noticing that the signal happened. This is very dangerous, right? That we're responding to data by taking action in a way that's completely divorced from our seeing of the data in the first place. So we need to get much more in touch with what our body is telling us. I see leaders all the time, and you see there are studies about this as well. People who go into meetings hungry, because leaders I work with are very busy, and they hate all the ideas. Like, they hate all the ideas on the table. None of the ideas are quite right. Well, is this about the quality of the ideas, or is this about the fact that you didn't have time for lunch? Like, we don't tend to think, oh my goodness, I hate these ideas because I have no blood sugar and I have no creativity left. But actually, this is the way our bodies work. You know, there's fabulous studies of the thing that makes you most likely to get parole when you are in front of a parole board in prison is how close to a break the judges are when they look at your case. If you're right after they ate lunch or breakfast, then you're very likely to get paroled. If you're right before it's time for a break or a meal, you're very unlikely to get paroled. Now, this has nothing to do with the merits of these cases, right? This wow. is completely because the judges are responding to a bodily sensation, but they don't know that they're responding to a bodily sensation. So they think they're responding logically. If we're more in touch with our bodies, we can avoid those mistakes.
Got it. I'm smiling to myself here as we speak. My wife uses the term hangry.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Like, this is a very clever way of understanding a signal that your body is giving you so that you don't blame other people for it.
Got it. No, but one is clearly the stomach and the hunger. But are there other common bodily signals that you see leaders missing? Are there one or two things that stand out for you apart from hunger, which you spoke about?
Oh, absolutely. Anxiety. Anxiety is huge, right? When we feel anxious, we make more protective decisions. We make more short-term decisions. And many organizations have leaders rushing so quickly from meeting to meeting, from crisis to crisis, that leaders spend a lot of their time anxious and not noticing that they're anxious. It's just like their regular way of walking through the world. They don't even notice that they're stressed or anxious, which is why mindfulness has come roaring into organizations, right? Because actually it gives you a moment to notice what's going on inside you, which then helps you decide, oh, how do I want to relate to this thing that's going on inside me? If I had a bad meeting an hour ago and it made me anxious, and then I come into this meeting now and I haven't dealt with that anxiety, I'm going to be ruled by this sort of short-term, fear-based, narrow vision that anxiety produces in the brain and in the body with this cortisol that rushes through my bloodstream. And I'm going to act out of that place probably without even noticing that I was anxious because of a thing that happened just now.
And maybe just to understand this further, Jennifer, even if we take anxiety, one would think it's a feeling or a signal to be processed from the mind. How do you think of this as a signal from the body? How does one listen to that signal?
You can notice, what does it do to your body, right? You can notice, like, what does anxiety show up as? Or are your palms sweating? Is your heart beating? What's your breathing doing? Do you clench your thighs or your belly under these circumstances? Like, we can tune into what are the signals I'm getting? Because the mind rationalizes things, right? Like, the core of this book is that we're constantly rationalizing the decisions we're making, the data we're processing. And so we can't just believe that we've got access to it. We need another set of clues, and figuring out what's going on in our body is very useful. The best way to process anxiety, by the way, is to exercise. So we actually want to burn it off. These hormones are in our bloodstream. And it's one of the problems with this lockdown right now is, how are people able to sweat out the anxiety that they're feeling versus how much are they just having this build up in them? Because anxiety is also particularly bad for long-term health and it's bad for our immune systems. It's bad for our mental and physical health. So being more connected to what's going on in your body is extraordinarily helpful in complexity.
I've also started believing in managing our energy rather than managing our time as a key element of driving productivity. I feel listening to our body is a key prerequisite for us to tune into our internal energy forces and get work done. Let's now talk about the third level of listening. Very often, when listening gets discussed, it's about paying attention to the other side, the person who's speaking. How do we focus not just on what the person is saying, but the body language and tune into why the person holds a certain set of beliefs and worldviews? Rajiv Vich, a coach in Singapore and the author of Inside Out Leadership, speaks about the third level of listening, which is about paying attention to what's happening inside us when we listen to the other person. It tells us a lot about our beliefs, convictions, mental models, relationship with the other person, and so on.
So just to clarify the three levels. So one is what you're saying, right? So let's say you are saying you made a hurtful comment, right? So that's what I'm hearing. And so that's one level of listening. I'm only reacting to or picking up only what you're saying. The other is I am empathetically listening and understanding, you know, you made a hurtful comment. Where is it coming from? Oh, you must be feeling frustrated about that issue. Or maybe you're feeling let down, or, you know, so now I'm being really empathetic and trying to engage in my mind on the feelings that you are experiencing, which are leading you to say what you're saying, right? So that's the next level. The final level, which is pretty hard, but quite powerful, is understanding what's going on within me. So when you made a hurtful comment and now I'm saying, oh, you know, maybe you got hurt about something, maybe I let you down in some way or something. What's going on within me? Maybe I'm feeling frustrated. Maybe I'm feeling angry. Or maybe I'm feeling regretful. And so on. And connecting with all these levels is so important because that raises the quality of the conversation. Firstly, it is going to alter my response, right? If I reacted to what you say something hurtful, I react to it, we know where that conversation is going to go. If I'm a little more empathetic and I understand where it's coming from, I will respond in a little better manner, right? Hopefully I'm kind of appreciative of where you are, what's happening, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm still not mindful of my own limitations here, which is that when somebody says something that seems sensitive, I very easily get into a very permissive mode because I like being kind to people, right? So again, if the communication and the interaction is not going to be most transformational or most effective because, okay, I picked up your sort of emotional cues, but my own emotional flaws or my own emotional triggers are still at play. So if I can become aware that, hey, I know I'm getting drawn into this emotional drama because that's my tendency. If I'm just aware of that, maybe I'll respond differently. And hence we will move forward on that conversation in a very calm, assertive, authentic, meaningful way. And it'll become a transformational conversation. So that's kind of the three levels of three layers of listening that I've noticed.
I guess we could keep going on and on about how we deepen our self-awareness. Hope this gives you a sense of an initial lay of the land in terms of the what and the how. Let's try and hop across to the other side and learn about deepening our external self-awareness in the next episode. But before we do that, let's recap the ground we have covered on the topic of internal self-awareness. We spoke about going beyond strengths and weaknesses and exploring other dimensions. We then discussed tuning into what is play for us in order to unearth our potential. We then looked at revisiting our formative years to see how we've been shaped by our early experiences and context. I guess a useful corollary to that is to be nimble-footed about our sense of self. Then we moved to the how of building internal self-awareness. We then looked at three dimensions of mindful alertness, especially during high-stakes situations. We discussed journaling, listening to our body, and practicing three levels of listening. As you would appreciate, this is a lifetime's pursuit and not something that can be mastered overnight. But at least knowing the vastness of the ocean is helpful in beginning to set sail in these waters. I hope you found this compilation of value. Needless to say, self-awareness is a journey and not a destination. I can say with absolute conviction that walking this path of self-awareness has made a profound difference to me in terms of providing greater career clarity, improved relationships with the people around me, and happiness in life in general. I hope this episode gave you some pointers to further walk this journey. Do tune into the next episode where we explore external self-awareness. And do consider sharing this episode with your friends, colleagues, or batchmates, or anyone else who thinks that they're really self-aware. As we discussed earlier in the episode, they are the ones that possibly need this the most. As you would appreciate, the series of Connecting the Dots is a new endeavor. Please do let me know if you have any feedback on the format. anything you want me to do more of, less of, or differently, that would really be valuable for me and my team. Thank you for listening and for your attention. Do also consider rating and reviewing us on Apple or Spotify or wherever else you consume this content. It would really mean a lot for us to keep raising the bar on what we do. We also have a WhatsApp group where we share one or two pieces of content for a week. While we run the Connecting the Dots series, we'll be sharing some nuggets along related themes. Over the next few days, we'll share some nuggets on self-awareness to build on what we discuss in this podcast episode. If you wish to receive this communication, you could just say interested and message +91 85914 52129. Do remember to add the number to your contacts list. That will make it easier for us to broadcast it to your number. I repeat, the number is +91 85914 52129. All you have to do is add it to your contacts and send a message saying interested. In the next episode of Connecting the Dots, we'll take a closer look at external self-awareness. I look forward to having you tune into that conversation. Till then, goodbye.